Welcome to the Passive Mobile Home Park Investing Podcast with your host, Andrew Keel. This is the podcast where you can get the education you need to invest 100% passively in the highly profitable niche of mobile home parks.
Welcome to the Passive Mobile Home Park Investing Podcast. I'm your host, Andrew Keel, and today we have an exciting episode. We have two special guests in Jake Bond and Paras Shah of GSC Investments. Jake Bond and Paras Shah are the co-founders and principals of GSC Investments, which they launched back in 2016. Since then, GSC has grown to operate and own over 40 mobile home communities, including two development projects. Welcome to the show, guys.
Yeah, thanks for having us, Andrew.
Thanks for coming on. Paras, maybe you can start us out by telling us a little about your story and, you know, how in the world you ended up in manufactured housing communities and starting GSC Investments.
Yeah, well, thanks again for having us. So, you know, Jake and I are actually known each other since 2005. And, you know, we were friends before we were business partners. And fast forward 10 years later in 2015, I'm applying for grad school. I got my master's in real estate development at USC. And coincidentally, Jake's younger brother, John, who's our third business partner and also a co-founder, was applying for the program at the same time. So Jake and I connected us two before we started the program. And, you know, John and I chatted and quickly realized we both wanted to be real estate entrepreneurs. And as we started the program, we were deciding on which asset class we wanted to focus on. You know, and John had reached out and suggested we look at MHC as an asset class. And I think like most investors, right, I kind of had a knee-jerk reaction, like, I don't know that I want to do mobile home parks. But I think it's, you know, the classic saying is some of the best investments are the ones where perception doesn't meet reality. And, you know, that's the case with MH, right? And so we started to underwrite the space and for a lot of the same fundamentals that I'm sure your other guests have spoken about or your listeners know about, right? We love this space, right? For us, you know, at that time, we didn't really have any capital backing us. And so it was really the three of us putting our own money into deals and raising small friends and family checks. It was an asset class we could still compete on, right? So, you know, this is 2016. Pricing hadn't got as crazy as it was in kind of 2020, 2022, but there was still a lot of capital chasing deals. And as we underwrote the space, you know, we realized like, hey, you could buy communities for $500,000. You could buy communities for like $100 million, right? So there was a pretty wide opportunity to compete. And so the three of us, you know, underwrote the space. We bought our first community in September of 2016. That was in New Mexico. It was a 100-lot community. And, you know, since then, we've just kind of hit the ground running and been heads down and focused. And, you know, to date, we've transacted on over 40 communities, own and operate, you know, north of 3,000 lots, as you mentioned. We do everything in-house, so property management, asset management. We have our dealer's license for our development deals where we buy and sell homes. And, you know, we're really excited about the space. I think there's a lot of tailwind behind us and are really excited for the future of it.
I love that. Would you mind going back to your first deal, those 100 yeah. lots in New Mexico? How did you establish your buying criteria at that point? And how did you really get educated on the asset class?
Yeah. So, you know, we went to the boot camp, right? Frank and Dave's boot camp, which is pretty popular. We read as much as we could about it. And, you know, as we started to underwrite deals, we were really focused on, for the first deal at least, having a business plan that was relatively low risk, right? So increasing income, perhaps addressing some deferred maintenance, public utilities was important to us, right? And so, you know, that was really kind of like our criteria, right? And in terms of lot count, we weren't as focused on that. Like we just wanted to get a deal done. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, I think we probably offered on 30 or 40 deals before we got our first one under contract. And it was hard, right? Like brokers, when you're new to the space, they don't really take you seriously, right? You're obviously, and I mean, especially today, you have a lot more capital chasing deals, a lot of new investors in the space. And so John, you know, he put together kind of a deal deck that more or less underwrote the space. And we started to send that out to brokers and, you know, let them know, like, look, we're serious, right? We're not just some passive investors that are, you know, trying to buy one deal. Like we want to build a portfolio. We want to scale. And luckily enough, we were able to, you know, be competitive on our first deal. I mean, honestly, we saw the listing and we offered full price and we just wanted to get it under contract, right? It kind of checked all the boxes for us. You know, we were looking for positive operating leverage day one, right? I think we bought that deal at around an A cap, which, I mean, today, if anything came at an A cap, we'd probably just send the money, tell us where to send the money, and we won't even do any DD.
Yeah.
But, you know, the industry's changed, right? It's 180 from where it was only, you know, 7-8 years ago. But that was really the criteria for us. Low risk deal in terms of execution of the business plan, you know, in a market that was relatively geographically close to us that we can go manage the property, you know, low amount of park owned homes, right? That was the other criteria for us, and public utilities.
Very nice. Very nice. Yeah. I love that you guys took the boot camp. I've been there 4 times and it's a great way. It's just a great way to get educated and, you know, have a baseline, right, to go off of.
Yeah,
Jake, 100%. Jake, let's pivot over to you, man. You know, really appreciate you joining us today. I know you're, before we hit record here, you said you're live, you're recording out of a manufactured home in one of your development projects you guys are working on. You know, maybe you can share a little bit about your background and kind of what you're up to, you know, today and recently.
Yeah, I'm here in Enumclaw at Crystal Mountain Residences, which is a ground-up development that we launched in 2021. We started bringing residents in last summer, and today we have roughly 26 homes on site. It's a 129-lot community, and it is a age-restricted 55-plus community, but fully amenitized. And I think we got really, really lucky as it relates to ground-up development and manufactured housing. As you know, the development game is all about yield on cost, and the reason you don't see more manufactured housing communities being developed these days is that, of course, everyone wants to be inside the city limits, so they have access to municipal water and sewer. Unfortunately, in most cases, the underlying value of the land relative to the density that you could otherwise get for other uses is just more than what you could justify for a manufactured housing community. As you know, we can't build vertically. We get no density, right? So we have to build horizontally, and that requires a lot of acreage, and you just get to a certain cost threshold on the underlying land where your yield, where you're providing an affordable product with lower rents as compared to apartments or condos, et cetera, townhouses, whatever it might be, where you can get more density. And you also have the ability to, frankly, just charge more, right? Mm-hmm. That yield on cost is greater. And so it just is not feasible. Enumclaw is a part of King County. The southeastern portion of King County. I myself live in Kirkland, which is just an eastern suburb of Seattle. It's about a 45-minute drive. It's roughly 30 miles from my house. And it just happens to be the very last parcel on the far east side of town before you are outside the city limits. And so that works, right? That happened to work, that location being just literally you hop the east property line, and all of a sudden you're no longer in the city. You don't have access to those resources, right? And so it penciled in this case, but it is a challenge as it relates to the production of manufactured housing moving forward. And that is also why we see a shrinking population of manufactured housing communities around the country every year. Because the sad reality is that there is a higher and better use based on the amount of income that can be generated for an alternative use, as compared to the existing use and the utilization of all that acreage.
Yeah, and I think I was looking at your website, and the average home in one of these communities, you know, sells for what? You know, 200,000?
Oh, I wish.
300,000?
Yeah, we wish, yeah. I think when we started pursuing development opportunities, it was pre-COVID. COVID had had an outsized impact on costs related to the production of homes, as well as the labor and materials to set the homes. So we've seen, just as an example, we've probably seen cost increase of no less than 40% on our average invoice from the manufacturer for the homes that we're ordering. And we've seen at least a 30% increase in the cost of the setup for these homes. Now, to be fair, this is kind of a five-star, spare no expense. It looks more like a single-family subdivision than it does a manufactured housing community. And you have two different, there are two different ways to approach it, right? There are some groups, in fact, I was just talking to one of them earlier in the week, that are kind of going for the maximum efficiency model, where they're much higher density, single-section homes, zero frills, you know, no upgrades, just absolute cheapest product they can get. They're selling homes for between $75,000 to call it $130,000. And the trade-off there is that they're getting larger lot rents. So it's, hey, we can sell you a home for really, really cheap. All of these are in the Dallas area. And I think generally speaking, costs in Dallas as compared to Western Washington are less. And the comps are less. The rents are less for apartments. The single family home sales are less. So, you know, they are competing with a different product there. But it's, you know, do not spend one more dollar than you need to. Absolute cheapest thing you can provide, and get as many homes per acre as possible. We're being a little bit more thoughtful as it relates to density, no more than six lots per acre. Everyone has a reasonable yard, and we are also building on-site garages that are tying into the homes at the eave near the utility door. So everyone has a one or two car garage, concrete driveways, concrete sidewalks, curbs.
Institutional quality, you know, type of property, very high level. Yeah.
Pit set homes rather than pier set homes, meaning that the homes, the grade of the homes look more like your stick built home, where
a subdivision, right?
Yeah, where the skirting, we're using a concrete type skirting, so it makes it look like a stem wall, right?
Oh, nice.
And there's about 6 to 8 inches between final grade and the belly band, which is basically the floor joists. Right. So it makes it look just like a stick built home. And what I would say is our customers are not people that are coming to us because we're the lowest price option. This is like a choice community. They're choosing a lifestyle. 9 out of 10 buyers are buying all cash. Unfortunately, the average cost of the home is much higher, between $300,000 and $400,000. But for the most part, folks are selling their stick built home. There's been some type of a catalyst in their life that has prompted them to want to make a lifestyle change. And sometimes that's the death of a spouse or a separation, or simply just the desire for a less expensive, so that, you know, lower maintenance, lower cost, more simplified lifestyle. I think on average are
real quick, just to kind of cut you off there. And sorry about that, Jake, but yeah. Did I hear you earlier? You said there's 26 occupied now. And it's like 125 lots total.
129 total.
So yeah. Would you say that that's been one of your challenges, is just, you know, the increasing occupancy, or how did you guys pro forma, you know, how many homes per year you would sell in that community?
Yeah. Our goal is to do 30 a year. I think that just from a labor standpoint, it becomes very challenging, right? So we push as hard as we can to bring as many homes in, set as many homes, et cetera. I think that in certain instances, we become a victim of the amount of opportunity that we have. As I was explaining earlier, people don't come to us because we're the lowest cost option. So in most instances, people come to us looking to spend more money. And there is a bit of frustration there, because we set up these very beautiful spec homes, and at least half of the people that end up buying a home here come to our spec homes, get an idea of what they want, and say, this is great. I want this exact home on that lot over there. You sure you don't want this home that you can move into today? No. I want to do a couple things that are special. Oh, well, that's going to cost you an extra $25,000. Ah, no problem. I just want what I want, right? Mm. So for better or worse, our buyers are not very price sensitive. And a lot of them are downsizing from larger stick-built homes. That's the point I was getting to earlier, in that for the most part, they're playing the arbitrage that exists between selling their stick-built home, pocketing the equity that they've accrued, using some portion of that cash to buy the home here all cash, and then pocketing the surplus cash flow. So most of them in that transition are setting aside $200,000, $300,000, $400,000 of cash. in the trade that exists between selling their stick built home, typically somewhere here in Western Washington, and buying a manufactured home in our community. And in turn, what they're doing is they're lowering their maintenance costs, they're lowering their property taxes, they're lowering their insurance, they're lowering their overall overhead as it relates to owning and maintaining the home. They know that they have a roof that is likely going to last them for the remainder of their lifetime. They're not going to have to worry about replacing the furnace, replacing the roof, et cetera. And they're able to just, for lack of a term, enjoy life, right?
Totally.
For things they no longer have to worry about.
It's downsizing, the typical downsizing.
Downsizing.
Yeah, I totally understand that model. Awesome that you guys are providing that, you know, in this area for sure, in the outskirts of Seattle, which is obviously a really good location for all of that. You know, going back to your guys' story, you know, go back to you, Paras, you know, if you had to do it all over again, you know, getting to this point with the type of properties you're going after and getting up to over 40 communities and a couple of development projects, you know, what would you do? What would you do differently if you had to do it all over again?
That's a great question. I mean, the easy answer is we would have bought everything we could have between 2016 and 2019.
Sure.
You know, I think when we started looking at the space, if you had told me we would be buying deals at four caps or sub four caps, something like crazy, right? Like that wasn't what the space was, right? But now, obviously, you know, investors have realized that, look, this is a great asset class from, you know, just from a pure economic standpoint, right? On a risk-adjusted basis, it's a very attractive return profile. And so that's the easy answer is we would have bought everything that we could have. You know, I think the other answer would be that I wish we were a little bit more aware of just how management intensive it is, right? So I think going into this space, we had no, you know, ideas or visions of being a property management company as well, right? So we have a third party affiliated property management company, but, you know, we thought we could outsource management, right? And you can do that in the multifamily world. You have the Gray Stars, you know, you have these large institutional property management companies, but an MH, like if you really want to kind of scale, you have to, in our opinion, you got to kind of manage in-house, right? And it's great because it's made us better underwriters. It's made us better operators, right? We understand what to look for, but it's extremely time consuming. And, you know, I don't think property management isn't like a sexy business by any means, right? And so I think we wish, you know, I wish we were a little bit more prepared for that, right? That was more of a reactive choice as opposed to us being proactive about it. And all in all, it's worked out great. We have a great team. But you know, that's a big part of business, right? It is very time consuming and you really got to make sure you're dialed in on that to make sure you can execute on your business plan and run your properties well.
Totally.
If I could piggyback on that, what is ironic about our background is that I came from the multifamily world where leading up to 2016, the majority of my experience was in investing in institutional, call it 200 to 400 unit apartment buildings around the country. And I just remember so vividly in talking with Boris and John and describing to them that, hey, this is great, but we really want to be on the asset management side. We do not want to be on the property management side. And here we are 40 plus properties later, in the state of Washington anyways, probably the largest MH property manager in the state. And we honestly would not be able to perform the way that we are and execute our business plans if we were hiring a third party option. There are a few third party options and we have tried them and certainly do not mean to denigrate them at all. It just, I think people say this in the multifamily world or other asset classes as well, but in manufactured housing, I think in order to provide a really tremendous experience for the residents and to be able to execute on the business plan, if you do hire a third-party property manager, it's unlikely you're going to get anything other than simply rent collection. If you're looking for anything outside of that, it's going to be really hard to find it.
Yeah, I've had the same experience. You know, so it's good to hear that I'm not the only one that kind of went the third-party route and then ended up, you know, having, you know, over 30 employees now in a management company that I didn't intend to start. But you know, going to you, Jake, you know, you self-manage all the communities, you know, would you say that's been the toughest hurdle that you guys have had to overcome, you know, to get to this point in regards to building your mobile home park investment platform? Or would you say there'd be some other things in addition to that?
I mean, I think that you learn most from life experiences. In particular, you learn most from when you stumble. I think the hardest part about manufactured housing is maintaining the quality and integrity of the community as well as the homes and the lots. And I think that people discount or do not take into account how difficult it truly is to be effective and efficient in bringing in new homes to revitalize the housing stock and make improvements in your neighborhood. If you can do it, then I think that puts you in a class in and of your own within the manufactured housing industry. And it is probably the best way to add value, not only to your community, but also to your residents. I think that a rising tide, so to speak, raises all ships, right? And manufactured housing communities are really no different than other neighborhoods that start to see improvements. So name your neighborhood in XYZ city, right? And we've seen this happen time and time again, especially over the course of the last 10 years. You have a neighborhood that, you know, historically wasn't getting a lot of attention, wasn't in great shape, and all of a sudden it becomes trendy and people start buying up the homes and making major improvements and or just tearing down what's there and building something new. And as that happens, it has the effect of helping everyone else around them realize some degree of appreciation. We have a community just down the street from Crystal Mountain here in Enumclaw called Diamond Valley, which has been a tremendous experience for all of us. We actually bought that one out of receivership, kind of like on a courthouse auction. Very, very rough shape when we first purchased it. I think Paris and I would both say that is the community where we cut our teeth. That is where we decided to launch our own property management arm, as well as our own dealer. We made a number of mistakes early on. So many mistakes so long ago, I can't even remember them. But it happened, absolutely. And in doing so, we acquired a community that had a failing water system, had not had an on-site management presence for probably a decade. Water was literally just coming out of the ground. They were losing so much water. The storm system had failed. So not only was it coming out of the ground, but then it was pooling up everywhere. Several abandoned homes. And at the time, we had roughly 75% occupancy in a market that's 100% occupied. And the only reason they were no longer 100% occupied is because there's literally no one there to answer the phone. Had there been someone there to answer the phone, people would have just brought their homes in and they would have been 100% occupied. And so we invested roughly $3 million back into that community. Our water and sewer bill, just as an example, was about $30,000 a month. When we first bought the community as a result of the water loss. Once we replaced the water system and remedied the water loss, our water and sewer bill came down to about $9,000 a month. So we immediately added $240,000 to the bottom line just through the cost reduction. And in addition to that, now today we are 100% occupied and our water and sewer bill is $14,000 to $15,000 a month. Right. And on top of that, we brought in roughly 30 plus new homes. When we first took on the property, people would literally sign their titles over to us. Like we had multiple people who left in the middle of the night, left their keys and a signed title on the doorstep and said, sayonara. We've had other residents who were at that community previously that left and swore they would never come back and have been so impressed with the improvements we've made that have actually come back. Bought brand new homes in the community. And
I think, is this the one you posted on LinkedIn about the now people can sell homes? They have equity in their homes of over.
I think that's the big thing, right? I think there's a misnomer out there that the equity values of these homes don't appreciate. But to Jake's point, it's no, you know, the dynamics are the same as a stick-built community, right? If it's well-located, well-run, it's clean, it's safe, you're going to have demand. And if you're going to have demand, then it's going to get competitive and people are going to be able to unlock equity in their homes and hopefully trade up, right? I mean, that's what the end goal should be. And so I know that we're particularly pretty proud of that because we've seen that across our portfolio. We've tracked the stats and, you know, I think that's something that, you know, hopefully the industry as a whole really tries to highlight more because, you know, we are in the affordable housing space and this is one solution to the affordable housing issues across the country. But more importantly, you know, residents who live in these communities, if they're run well, clean, safe, et cetera, like they're gonna be able to unlock equity when they sell, right? And so I think that's been something that we're super excited about and, you know, hopefully continue to be able to execute on.
Great, it's a win-win, right? The residents 100%. Are getting that equity and then, you know, it's just a really good overall, you know, benefit.
Building up to there, Andrew, is that I don't know how he knew who I was, but just a couple of years ago, I had a resident in that community who came up to me while I was there working on a project and said, "Hey, I just want to thank you. Because of the investment that you've made in this community, I've been able to sell my home for $175,000 and I'm using those dollars to go buy a stick-built home. I never thought my family and I would be able to own a stick-built home. And the only reason we're able to do that is because the investment you made in this community and the amount by which our home is appreciated as a result is really, really cool."
That's so cool, Jake. Yeah. To be able to be a part of that. And then also to make it a win for your investors too, right? Because I'm sure a lot of that had to go up. You invested $3 million into the property. And I love that. That's really cool. You know, going back to your development projects, you know, I wanted to make sure I asked, like, what would you guys do differently? And what would you say are like the most important aspects? You know, maybe Paras, you can talk on this point. You know, what are the most important aspects of a ground up deal? And you know, are you guys going to continue to develop? I mean, you guys started, I think you said you started pre-COVID and then 2021 was this first one. Like you kind of got dealt a bad hand there with costs going up. And then obviously the COVID costs of the manufactured housing has kind of stayed where the cost of the brand new housing is there. So yeah, what are the most important aspects and you know, are you going to continue?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think the managing of your bringing in your homes, right, is really critical. So in Washington, you know, we're in a pretty high cost market. I think the other challenge that we face is, and I don't think this is so much of an issue in other parts of the country, but there aren't a lot of like setup vendors, right? A lot of them actually, you know, during the Great Recession, right? And there are other trades. And so there's a huge void of really quality setup crews. And so if you're looking at a development project, you know, I think you really want to be dialed in on your absorption and not being unrealistic in terms of how quickly you think you can lease up the community. And I also think that the bringing in, the setting up, the selling of the homes, you know, it's extremely working capital intensive. And there really isn't a great financing solution out there for the actual setup costs, right? So you can obviously floor the cost of the homes with the triads and the North Points and get flooring facilities, and that's great. But the setup of the homes, right? And like, and again, in our particular case, you know, we are doing like all the bells and whistles and it's 5-star community. So the costs are pretty high, but like our setup costs are like $150,000, right? And that includes your permits, that includes your on-site garages, that includes everything. That's not cheap, right? And you can't finance that. So that's all equity, right? So, and then, you know, you add in the fact that, you know, we have obviously weather-related issues, right? With the Northwest, the winters are pretty cold. So your sales cycle is shorter. So all those things kind of snowball when you're looking at underwriting a deal. And I think that you really have to be realistic of your absorption and the cost it takes to bring in, set up, sell these homes, rinse and repeat, right? Rinse and repeat. That's, you know, a challenge that we face every day. And, you know, from our standpoint, like you take a step back from a macro perspective, we know once we execute, we're going to have a phenomenal asset on our hands. But, you know, what originally we thought was going to take 4 to 5 years to get there, it's probably going to take closer to 6 or 7, right? And that could be the make or break on your deal, right? So that's been the challenge. I think that in terms of doing future development, you know, it's frustrating in a way because, again, like, I think this is a real solution, one solution, right, to the affordable housing issue. And I think we always talk about it internally. If you're building an all-age community, like, this is the new starter home, right? And they're really great homes. And if you're doing a 55-plus community, like, this is a great retirement community, right? So there seems to be, like, from just a pure product standpoint, a great fit, right? Where you think we're solving problems. The challenge is it's just really hard to execute. You know, again, like, your lease up, it's not like apartments. You build the apartment and, you know, your lease up is 12, 18 months. Like, these are long lease up cycles, and you need to find the right capital that's patient and that's willing to kind of go through the ups and downs with you. But, you know, you get to the other side of it, you have a phenomenal asset on your hand that is very, very, very tough to replicate. So I would say we'd love to do development again. I think we got to get through the ones that we have on our hands and get a little further down to, you know, I guess let's say further leased up before we take on another one. But all in all, we are really excited about them. And, you know, again, we think that if you can develop, it's a great opportunity to do so and solve the problem and make great returns for your investors.
Totally. Pivot over.
I actually had a really great conversation earlier this week with a fellow MH owner who's really focused on trying to create new legislation around that, because it comes down to what I referenced earlier on the call as it relates to feasibility and highest and best use for the underlying land. And when we're trying to create an affordable product at an affordable price, is it realistic that you're going to pay the same dollar amount for the capital facility charges, for the permits, for all the things that come along with it, if they're encouraging you to build an affordable product, right? How is it that the municipalities can charge top dollar for the same exact thing across all uses, right? But then expect to create an affordable product? Is that realistic?
Yeah, that's a great question. Jake, maybe you can talk a little bit about your most recent acquisitions. And, you know, it's been tougher to get deals done the last couple of years with higher interest rates. How have you guys pivoted around that?
I don't know that we've necessarily pivoted around that, right? I mean, I'd like to think that we have secret sauce, but ultimately, we historically have not pursued a lot of deals that have been marketed. John has been just tremendous as it relates to creating deal flow for us and really acting almost as an in-house broker, pounding the pavement, making house calls, going and seeing property owners, following up with them by phone, even befriending some of them. And I think just persistence, a lot of the deals that we have been able to close on, and this most recent acquisition in Helena, Montana is a great example where it was a 2-year process of getting to know the property owner, getting that property owner comfortable with us, and then just timing as it relates to their decision to want to move forward with the sale, right? That's not going to be a winning recipe for every single deal that we want to pursue. And there are going to be some property owners that do want to market the property broadly for sale. Because everyone wants to get top dollar. I think that we've been able to create some of our own luck as it relates to finding deals that pencil and that we can go out and raise capital for through just persistence of following up with certain property owners. And separately, because of what's been happening in the capital markets, if you look at our track record, We did one deal in 2023, and the way we got that deal done was through seller financing, right? We can offer a reasonable price as long, because ultimately we're all in the yield game, you know?
Sure.
Call it whatever you want to call it. I think now has been the greatest example in recent history of just how sensitive capital markets are to yield, right? And when we've seen interest rates increase and people can get 4 or 5% on treasuries, right? They can go to, I mean, just globally, you look at the macro landscape, there's significantly more money that is flowing in the credit strategies as compared to equity strategies, because in a lot of credit strategies right now, you can get 9, 10, 11, 12%, right? Now, in a down market, there are going to be some disadvantages to both credit and equity. And in a down market, I mean, you're seeing it firsthand in office, right? There are a lot of lenders that are taking back assets, right? And that in a down market, maybe there's, point I'm trying to make is nothing is risk-free. So even if you're getting that 10, 11, 12% in a credit strategy of the day, that doesn't mean you're going to get that forever. It doesn't mean you aren't going to run into stumbling blocks, right? Nothing is risk-free. But we were able to create a scenario where there was positive leverage going in on that particular acquisition in 2023. And then as we've been in 2024, to date, there have been three deals that we've closed on. One is an RV park in Austin, Texas, where, again, I think pricing was fair, certainly not egregious. It was important to the seller who he sold to. These are primarily long-term tenants. So 96 spaces and only 11 of them are open for transient tenants that are in and out. The other 85 are for long-term use. So operates in some respects the same as a manufactured housing community. And again, very favorable seller financing terms, right? We're not having to go to the debt markets and get debt at you know, today's rate. We acquired a really, really high-end premier community in Boise, Idaho, that is kind of like a redevelopment, we'll call it. It's pretty interesting. There's an aerial in the office that shows what the community was when it was 100% leased, 130 lots, nice multi-section homes, nice carports. Property owner about 20 years ago decided that she was no longer happy with the way the community looked, kicked everyone out except for one home.
Jeez.
Totally vacated the entire site, got a conditional use permit to build single family homes on 20 of the sites. And she sold those. They're called patio homes, but they're single story efficiency homes. It's a 55 plus community as well. Sold those on land leases. And then after the city would no longer provide conditional use permits for that, she started bringing in really high end manufactured homes, no different than our development projects here in Washington, Crystal Mountain and Lavender Meadows, but just ran out of steam. She got 55 of the 130 lots occupied and ran out of steam. And we were able to buy at a pretty considerable discount to replacement cost and just create a scenario relative to what we were talking about, where even though we're not anticipating enormous lease up numbers in a very quick period of time, our yield on cost justifies the effort. And it's, once fully occupied, I think it's probably the nicest, highest quality community, certainly in the state of Idaho, maybe in the Pacific Northwest.
Wow. Wow. Yeah. Paras, talk to me about regulation and rent control. The Pacific Northwest is known for that. And, you know, just curious how you guys, you know, look at that in your investment strategy.
Yeah, it's a great question. Obviously, Oregon has statewide rent control. Washington to date does not have rent control. Of course, it's been on the docket for the last few years. And look, I mean, it's something we discuss all the time internally. You know, Jake has certainly been involved in a lot of the discussions with legislators and the lobbying groups. And, you know, our viewpoint on it is, you know, let's focus on what we can control and let's certainly make sure our voice is heard and, you know, lobby and try to educate legislators on why we think rent control is bad. You know, I think there's enough data out there that obviously suggests that, listen, it ends up driving up housing costs, reduces affordability, right? You look at LA, San Francisco, New York, some of the highest cost markets in the state, where they all have in common rent control, right? So
reduces supply.
Yeah, reduces supply. Obviously, you know, people aren't going to invest in properties, right? So we continue to look actively in Washington. But it's a risk that you have to underwrite to, and you have to figure out how to mitigate, right?
And that's what I'm curious about, though, is like for your, you know, your active investments, you know, how do you underwrite around, you know, say, you know, in the middle of your, you know, your game plan, you know, that gets enacted? Like, how would that change things?
I think, you know, yeah. So we as operators try to be really conscious of our rent increases, right? We don't want to go in and jack rents day one, right, to market. We try to get there systematically over time. And I think specifically in the state of Washington, one way to mitigate it as you're underwriting it, or, you know, other markets that potentially have rent control on the horizon. One is like, make sure you buy right, right, to price in that risk. Two, if you have a longer hold period, right, and you can underwrite to that, then hopefully you get there over time. But it is a hard, I mean, it's a hard risk to mitigate, right? Because again, it's out of your control. And, you know, the sad reality is what happens is if it is a potential item that gets passed, right, then what a lot of owners do, they start jacking rents to get ahead of it, right? And it has this vicious cycle, which again, almost, it has this unintended consequence of just rising prices, right? So it does the exact opposite of what it's trying to do. And it's tough. I mean, it's just, you have to figure out, I think the best way to mitigate it is, like, honestly, to buy right.
And I think, you know, you guys are value add investors, right? You're typically not buying something stabilized and just going to plan on 3% or 5% rent increases. You know, you're investing $3 million like that one property that you bought on the courthouse steps, you know? So I just wonder how that kind of, you know, your rent increases are justified. It's not like you're just buying it and that's all you're doing. So I think you need to be able to do that, you know, to
yeah. And a lot of it honestly is like, we try to educate our residents as much and be as transparent as we can mm-hmm. on the capital, you know, improvements that we're making, and, you know, try to show the data that look like this is like, you're going to recognize the value of this if and when you sell the home. Right. And there's a cost for everything. Right. And I think the other part of it that doesn't get discussed enough is like property taxes. I mean, those have jumped 30, 40, 50% on us. Right. And so it's frankly, like, we try to just be transparent and communicate with our residents and educate them and, you know, do the best that we can to try to offer our communities.
Awesome. I'd like to try to summarize, get this episode finished in like the next 12 minutes, but I got a bunch of questions I want to fly through with you guys. So Jake, I'll pivot over to you. Let's just kind of try to get them all in the last like 12 minutes here. But, you know, I wanted to ask, when you bought your first property in New Mexico, the 100 lots, you know, how has your strategy changed since then? Right? Like seems like you're kind of fleeting to quality and more institutional, you know, type of assets. Would you agree? And what other strategies, you know, or changes have you made to your strategy?
Yeah, that's correct. We've definitely moved more towards higher quality or taking on projects like the Brookview project in Boise that I described earlier. Diamond Valley is a great example. We purchased a community in Pocatello, Idaho, that is, in every shape and form, the exact replica of Diamond Valley.
So you're fleeting to quality in like better areas. I mean, like New Mexico, you didn't say the MSA, but it is that, you know, and no, then I guess why, and if that's the strategy.
Yeah, I mean, everyone wants to be in strong markets, but I think that Paris and I are going to prioritize the quality of the community. It's not that we wouldn't go back to New Mexico at all, right? It's that we want it to be really high quality, and we think that the higher quality communities or opportunities like Diamond Valley or this community, Golden Hills and Pocatello, where we can create high quality through improvement, right? That's where we want to be, because that is what is going to create the most value for the residents, right? It's really hard, I think, to justify rent increases at a 1- and 2-star community that aren't seeing any improvements and frankly just don't even have the opportunity for improvement. They're just so far gone. So we're not, you know, cigar butt type investors, so to speak, right? Where we're just trying to extract as much cash as possible and move on.
Is the theory that those are stickier tenants in those quality communities?
I think it's like our view on it is, hey, we'd rather pay up for quality for a couple of reasons. One, I think you get a better, you know, better tenant base, right? Mm-hmm. And when units turn, you get a better tenant. And then two, I just think your downside risk from an investment standpoint, right? Or an investor standpoint, is much lower, right? And then I think three, we believe that when and if we go to sell, right, the quality is going to demand a lower cap rate or a higher price. And so you know, I just think on a risk adjusted basis, right, it ends up being a better return profile.
Well, I would add to that, the fourth pillar is the value proposition that we're selling. At the end of the day, we are competing with apartments. We are competing with single family homes, right? We need to be cognizant of what we're competing with. And we need to be cognizant of the value proposition that we're selling. That's our business, right? So it is much easier to sell the value proposition at a higher quality community as compared to the alternatives that consumers have if they're going to go rent a house or they're going to go rent an apartment or they're going to go buy a home or a condo, right? It's much easier to sell that value proposition at a high quality community than it is in a low quality community where you've got alternatives.
Yeah. And I think my strategy has been, you know, quite different than your guys. I'm buying more C quality assets and adding value to them, infill, kind of, you know, fixing the deferred maintenance mom and pops forgot about. You know, but I'm not competing with apartments or single family because those their pricing is just, you know, 3x what our lot rents are. So it's just
it sounds like, you know, like your strategy is, hey, I'm buying a C and I want to get it to B, right? Like I want to make improvements, right? And improve the quality overall.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But the alternative is what happens in a down market? Because like from an investor standpoint, one of the pillars of investing in manufactured housing is that you very rarely lose occupancy. You got to be doing things really poorly in order to lose occupancy. Mm-hmm. Whereas in a recession, I was an apartment investor in the Great Recession, right? We went from being 100% occupied to being 70% occupied overnight. People gone, middle of the night, out of there, gone, right? You don't have the same type of fleeting of residents in a down economy in your manufactured housing communities. And you're not having to go backwards on rents. Because what did we do with those apartments when we were at 70% occupancy? If our one, let's say, you know, one bedroom apartments were renting for $1,600 before the recession, well, now we're renting them for $1,100 because that's what we have to do in order to retent the building. You don't do that in manufactured housing. You may not be able to go up, but you're going to stay constant, right? So you're going to maintain occupancy. You're going to maintain those rents. And in a down market where you have apartments that you're competing with or single family homes you're competing with, where the price starts to go down, right? Then, you know, you could get caught in a bad spot. So that's why I think we just put so much emphasis on that value proposition that exists of like, hey, we're creating value here for people that's much easier for us to not only exhibit, but also sell. And we're not going to put ourselves in a tough spot because I think there are a lot of operators out there that have bought lower quality communities, increased the lot rents dramatically because all the other communities in the market are charging that much, right? And if we get in a position where the price of homes start to go down dramatically, the price of apartments start to go down dramatically, people are not going to want to pay the same amount to continue to be at these lower class communities.
Totally. Yeah. It's just, I think a lot of the apartment rents are, you know, $1,100 and then lot rents are like $350, $400.
So much
lower. There's just,
I think as long as there's like a 50% spread, right? Yeah. You have a pretty good margin of safety.
Totally. Yeah. And there's a ton of different ways, but I love your guys' quality method as well. Real quick here, if you guys were going to invest, Paras, we'll go to you. If you were going to invest in a mobile home park deal, like a syndication passively, what would be like the most important things you would look at? You know, just unbiased third party, investing in a new operator, you know, what would you look at to try to ensure success?
Well, that, you know, what I just mentioned is one of them, right? What's the spread between, let's call it a two bed, two bath apartment and lot rents, right? And trying to make sure there's a healthy margin there. I'd want to know how they manage the properties, right? Relative to our conversation earlier about in-house management versus outsourcing that, right? Obviously track record, you know, that's stating the obvious, that's super important. And then, you know, I think you want to look at, well, hey, like what is the business plan here, right? Are they going from lot rents, you know, $300 year one to $600 year, you know, immediately, right? Like, is that sustainable? Is that doable, right? And what does that look like, you know, obviously on your cap rates and your operating leverage day one? Obviously right now, a lot of investors are focused on cash yield, right? What's my going in cash yield? What's my going in cash yield? I think that's really important, but like, you know, we're not investing in these deals for 1 year, right? And so you got to really look at it like, okay, maybe if my cash yield is low going in, what's the story behind it? And then two, like, am I going to get to where I want to get, you know, within years five, within years seven? I think that's been the challenge for us on some of these syndications, right? Is everyone's focused on 1 year, but it's like, guys, like, you're not investing for 1 year, you're investing for 10 years. So like, let's look at the whole picture. But that's some of the stuff that I would look at.
Yeah. How about you, Jake? Would you add anything?
No, I think Paris nailed it. What you're getting in these communities is the durability of income, kind of like I just explained, relative to what happens in a down market with other alternative forms of housing, right? It was painful in the Great Recession when we lost all of those residents and then had to cut our rates by 30, 40%. That model didn't work very well. If you were in a position to hold on, you did great. You weathered the storm. But I think here, it's the stability and the durability of that income in both, an up market and a down market that is the real X factor.
Totally. Yeah. Paris, what do you think is the biggest threat to mobile home park investing?
Yeah, I mean, obviously legislation is one, right? I think that my hope is that, you know, we as an industry can just kind of continue to inform, you know, the general public of like, listen, these aren't kind of the, you know, not all communities are quote unquote trailer parks, right? And I think unfortunately there still is that perception out there, but like these are really quality homes. I mean, I think a great example is like everyone loves modular homes, right? Modular homes are sexy, et cetera. Like manufactured homes are no different. They're just, you know, governed by the HUD code, right? But, you know, for some reason, like it just hasn't caught on with MH, right? And so I just think there continues to be like a public education campaign on like, listen, these are really, really quality, affordable homes that people can unlock equity value in, use to trade up. And it is a real, you know, one solution to the affordable housing issue that the country faces. And so, you know, in terms of threat, like just legislative risk, and then, you know, again, just trying to change the public's perception about this asset class, you know, from both a housing perspective and, you know, and just quality perspective.
And do you think any sort of like tiny homes or 3D printing, you know,
yeah,
has any risk to the MH?
No, like the tiny homes, we get that question a lot. I think with the tiny homes, you're looking at affordability, but you're also looking at like a really unique lifestyle, right?
Yeah.
And you actually look at the cost of the tiny homes, they're not like dramatically cheaper than a manufactured home, right? So like, unless you're really looking for like that minimalist lifestyle, that small footprint, you know, most people would tell them like, hey, spend 20 grand more, you're going to get double the space. They're going to be like, yeah, like all day long.
Sure.
Right. So
exactly.
I don't necessarily think it's a threat because again, I think it's such a unique niche of people that want to actually live that lifestyle. It obviously has the affordability component to it. But you know, I don't really think it's a threat. I think it's just, you know, another subsect of kind of affordable housing.
Awesome. Well, thank you guys so much for coming on and sharing your model and sharing your story. You know, I really appreciate it. Jake, if any of our listeners would like to get a hold of you guys or, you know, have an interest in investing, what would be the best way for them to do so?
Yeah, likely through email. Paris and I can be reached either at jake@gscinvestments.com or paris@gscinvestments.com. Feel free to reach out anytime. And I'll leave you with this. Today, anyways, manufactured housing is the only form of affordable housing that is unsubsidized.
Yeah.
That's huge. Yeah. Awesome, guys. Well, thanks again for coming on the show. Really appreciate it. That's it for today, folks. Reminder, if you got value out of this episode, please leave us a review. Thank you all so much for tuning in.
Thanks, Andrew. Appreciate you having us.
Yeah, thanks, guys.
Take care.
Would you like to see mobile home park value add projects in progress? If so, follow us on Instagram at @passivemhpinvesting for photos and awesome videos from our recent mobile home park acquisitions. Once again, that's @passivemhpinvesting on Instagram. See you there.